to Eurovision, a podcast series that explores the extractivist gaze of European institutions and policies as a way to look beyond these extractive practices to the possibility of thinking and doing otherwise. My name is Audrey Sanson, part of the artist duo Fraud.
With myself, Francisco Gallardo, and in our practice, we invested in building critical spatial literacy.
In this case, into the inscriptive operations of the EU's Critical Raw Materials Initiative. Previous episodes focused on certain measures of conservation in fisheries, such as maximal sustainable yield, which were historically put in place to protect domestic industry rather than, for example, fish populations. These measures often reinforce legacies of pelagic extraction. So the following episode will focus on the situation from the perspective of fisher folk, in this case, Mr. Nai Aite Sake and Mr. Solomon Sampa, traditional fisher people from the Greater Accra area in Ghana. And Solomon Sampa's testimony will be read by Mac Darlik Nyanza Kobina, translated from Ga. And these testimonies will be put in conversation with a text by Dr. Epifania Amu Adare. Dr. Amu Adare is an artist, renegade architect, pedagogue, and researcher based in Accra, and she discusses critical spatial literacy as a crucial theoretical framework for analyzing and understanding the dynamics of the social construction of urban space. She is currently engaged in what she describes as the art of unthinking, and this is what we will be doing today. And so in her article, Who Rules the Waves? A Critical Reading of an Othered Modern Future, she provides a critical reading of Ghana's depleting marine landscape, framed as the othering of artisanal fishermen, fish mothers, and their fishmongers. And she questions the very idea of development and calls for the creation of a pluriversal alternate. Her understanding of spatial literacy has been very important for our practice. We're very thankful to have a chance to discuss this firsthand with her, and also to the fisherfolk who have entrusted us with their testimonies. So before we delve into how fishery population management has impacted artisanal fisheries, we begin with a short excerpt from Kofi Kinata's song, Illegal Fishing, which was commissioned by the Ghanaian Ministry of Fisheries.
Move. Abedimpo. Fisheries Commission, Canoe Council, Aiko. Kwame Kofi Kinata.
Could you explain to us what is happening in this song that Epifania you include in your article?
In this 2019 song, the Takoradi-based musician and songwriter Kofi Kinata serves as a mouthpiece of sorts for the Ghana government, more specifically for the Ministry for Fisheries and Agriculture, and in its efforts to popularize the idea of a fishing ban to be carried out over approximately a two-month period every year. Popularly referred to as the Fanti rap god, Kofi Kinata was perfectly placed to use his influence to facilitate the implementation of the government's closed fishing season policy, thus consequently helping to raise awareness on this national issue through the airwaves, on TV, and over social media. In this regard, a major influencer such as Kofi Kinata was absolutely instrumental for promoting an important aspect of work for the Ghana Sustainable Fisheries Management Project, which was basically a five-year USAID-funded project from October 2014 to October 2019. And this was a project to re-establish marine fishery stocks through the promotion of responsible fishing practices, and in this case specifically, their mandate to end the overfishing of key stocks important to local food security. In this music video, Kofi Kinata appeals to various social and spiritual sensibilities, beginning by reminding everyone that it is God who created planet Earth, including the ocean and its inhabitants, that serve as important sources of food and livelihood opportunities. Yet, unfortunately, these divine resources are being drastically depleted, and their marine environment is also being destroyed due to what Kenyatta describes as selfish ways and a love of money that leads to the use of a wide range of illegal fishing practices. This has got to stop, he says. Basically, the exploitative use of dynamite, carbide, light, and small fishing nets to overfish the waters. All this must come to an end, alongside a money is everything attitude and the flagrant ignoring of traditional taboos such as not fishing on Tuesdays. In conclusion, the heralding of a closed fishing season serves as a key mechanism for halting illegal fishing practices, thus ensuring the rejuvenation of existing fish stock.
When I asked the fisher folk about whether there was still a fishing ban in August and their thoughts about it, they had the following to say.
Yes, there is, but it's not all that complies by it. We, the local ones, we try our best to comply by it because we hope that by the end of the ban, at least the little fishes might have grown for us to go and catch. But some of the cycles are still on the waters. So whilst we don't go, they'll be there and still catch and store on their vessels or ships there and later sell it to some of the fisher folks that goes to them.
Can you explain ten year deal with negation to generate na alone? Ten year deal or your fuel it and you take all it and load your fuel it.
There was a ban on fishing for the month of August by the Fisheries Ministry. They said this will allow the smaller fishes to grow, but instead, the fishing trawlers were busy during the month fishing on our waters. During the ban, the local fishermen complained about the bigger vessels, but they continue their fishing expedition on our waters, and we complained to government, but to no avail. This is because they tax some of these vessels to make money, I guess. When you ask someone to fast, there should be food ready for the person after the fasting. If you ask someone to fast, and you did not put food for them after the fast, that means the person will die after the fast. Fisher folks here these days have many of our children in school. And so when you ask us to sit at home for a month, what do you expect us to eat? We have wives and children, and our income comes from the fishing business. The politicians have huge vehicles and monies in their accounts. So do not care for the ordinary fisher folks. When they go to the bank, their accounts are full with money. They ask us to sit at home and go hungry with our families. This is stupidity.
It was striking to hear the two-tiered system described by Ni Aite and Solomon that this fishing ban created. Could you explain, Epifania, in what way Kenyatta's song speaks to the neo-colonial gold rush that you and the fisher folk have identified in Ghanaian waters and also the global south at large?
What this song highlights for me is the dire straits that a hyper-capitalistic landscape produces, with its unevenness of development and increased social inequality. In this case, Ghana's upper four artisanal fisherfolk have been driven into a desperate battle for income to be generated by any means necessary, to the extent that even their traditions are being flaunted. To cap it all, this proverbial late capitalism struggle with more losers than winners occurs within an extremely rigged competition for dominance over an ocean that has already been overrun by large-scale actors with extensive financial resources and greater political clout than the upper four. It is this hyper-industrialization of many agricultural industries that has us now in the thick of a profit-obsessed society, where big business squeezes almost everyone out of even their everyday subsistence practices. So while huge profits are made through monopolization, privatization, extraction, and other challenging practices, the environment suffers. Other species become extinct, and the least among us fall into poverty, depression, hardship, and in the worst circumstances, death by starvation or suicide. And yet, all this is considered as our pathway towards civilization and progress.
Indeed. We asked fisher folk to describe the situation in the waters near Accra, and this is partially to bring to light the discrepancies with the ideology of progress and civilization, which you refer to. And in fact, in whose interest is this so-called progression? And who is also being left behind? And so the following is Solomon Sampa's testimony, a fisherman since 45 years, translated and read by Mac Darling, followed by a testimony by Ni Ayite Sake.
How long have you worked as a fisherman?
45 years.
Wow. But you are one of the pioneers, old time, Nene.
Yeah, 45 years.
I started working as a fisherman 45 years ago in Accra. There are some shortage of fish in our system, and the fisher folks are complaining. Currently, we only get smaller fishes and few bigger fish, such as redfish. There is no fishes in our sea or waters. You can come around here to witness the complaint from the fisher folks. It's all over the coastal fishing towns. Meanwhile, boats and vessels from Togo and Cote d'Ivoire are plying our waters. The government noticed this and so asked us to sit at home for a month so the fishes will grow. Very sad that our government encouraged us to sit at home for a month when they know our lives, livelihood depend on fishing business to take care of our family. We just complain to the authorities if there's something they can do to assist us. But they did not care much because we are just fisher folks. The government should have given monies to the fishermen. They rather gave monies to our bosses. They did not give us anything. This is one of the saddest moments for the fishermen. They told us that the fishing trawlers will also sit for a month, but they did not. The trawlers make life difficult for fisher folks. These started after 1983, after Ghana went through hunger and starvation. After 1983, they brought Chinese boats and trawlers to compete with us. There are millions of such trawlers in our water. You should be on our beach this morning and you will notice there's no fish. We have a strong challenge with fish on our waters, and the big vessels bully us on our sea using horrible strategies such as the use of electric bulb in fishing, known as light fishing. They also arouse those of us using smaller boats and light boats. They use nets that has smaller holes to catch all fishes in their reach, including the smaller ones. They also use bigger metals to destroy our nets when they pass by our fishing area. Sometimes the waves from their boats affect our smaller boats. No one to speak for the fisher folks here. Everything these days is politics.
In the past, mostly it used to be we, the local fishermen. But for some time now, we have realized that foreign fisher folks have invaded our waters. It makes it difficult for us to catch the kind of fishes we used to. So in most cases, we have some of these big vessels coming in into our waters. And we, the local ones, we have smaller boats and smaller nets. But they come with a bigger ship, with bigger nets and all kinds of devices to trap most of the fishes in the waters. So that has been one of our challenges. For now, there is little we can do as the local fishermen, because some of these are in the hands of the government to put in some programs or policies that would regulate how we fish on the waters here. At least if they can allow we, the local ones, to, you know, go beyond where we used to go. And if they can also reduce some of these big vessels that come into our waters, we think that it will have a balanced, fair deal for both of us.
According to these testimonies, the ban is a performance of governmental intervention, which is not helping the fisher folk. Now, one of the reasons why it was important for us to speak to fisher folk is also because, like Donna Haraway and others, you, Epifania, advocate the importance of anecdotal observations as an expansion from scientifically certifiable evidences. And so the fisher folk testimony clearly puts into question the validity of conservation measures such as MSY, which is something that we discussed in the last episode. And you've also discussed in other articles how unthinking science may be useful and even necessary. So with this in mind, how could this help us to strive for social and epistemic justice? And what modes of creative practices of decolonial doing, knowing, loving, and becoming might this engender?
So bearing this rigid landscape in mind, and if we are also to become Nipampa, a tree term that I like because it denotes the idea of someone being a truly humane being, then our task is twofold. First, we have the grander and perhaps even impossible task of imagining an alternative way of being on this blue-green planet. More specifically, there is now an urgent need to seek new ways of becoming consciously human, to identify new modes of being that would certainly require of us a paradigm shift from me to we consciousness, as Anna Louise Keaton would say. Requires to adhere to differing cosmologies and epistemologies that demand of us a shift away from the human nature split into other more relational ontologies, that is, ones which do not see the environment and other species as fodder for our very peculiar, skewed, and rather flawed notions of progress. In other words, we must engage in what critical educator Paulo Freire describes as conscious practical work. This being for our imminent delinking from the colonial matrix of power, a rather apt concept derived by Annibal Quijano to elucidate a very long and tragic colonial history with continuous and ongoing effects. Delinking must result in defensive moves towards the reconstitution of many worlds otherwise, as Escobar would say. After all, our ultimate imperative is to enable social and cognitive justice the world over. At the same time, we have the not so mundane second task, which is to ensure that the least amongst us are also able to obtain a basic and decent standard of living within the very system that we wish to dismantle totally. So in effect, we are tasked with rebuilding the Titanic while we are in a guaranteed process of also drowning with it at sea. These two scopes of work are indeed complex. Complicated and contradictory tasks that require from us a form of border consciousness, to use a term coined by Gloria Anzaldúa. That is an ability to dwell in the discomfort of in-betweens, to reside in the risk of the certain ambiguity that there are in fact many unknown unknowns waiting for us within the precarious safety of life as usual. A clear example of this is our current post-COVID predicament, within which conditions change as rapidly as our days disappear in anxiety, fear, and a paradoxically busy kind of wait and see. We are at a crossroads, literally and figuratively. We are on a precarious perch between life and death, an intersection that perhaps even Eshu, the Yoruba keeper of the crossroads, also known as Eshu Elegua or Papa Legba in the African diaspora, even Eshu might very well shy away from this perch. We are caught between the comfort of our tried, tested, and failing past ways and the vast uncertainty of this other world that has arrived largely without our consent, but certainly all because of our stubborn adherence to years of exploitative business as usual. It is a threshold such as this, a veritable liminal space that requires of us much unlearning, plus what I would describe as an unthinking of science as we know it. By this, I refer to the need to move beyond fixed either-or binary modes of being into more open-ended both-and relational ways of becoming. And these are terms that Ana Louise Keaton talks about. In my nascent conceptualization of just one example of a way forward, I would argue that this brave new world of ours needs many forays into the creation of art and beauty, into an embracing of healing, dreaming, and other regenerative modes of being, into a daily practice of meditation, gratitude, and prayerfulness, into constant cycles of affirmation and visioning towards conscious manifestation, into enabling the communal to preside over intense privatization, into I do not know taking precedence over I know, into honoring more cyclical modes of simple existence as opposed to the linear ideas of continuous growth and expansion that is our supposed progress, into sensing our way deeper into and through the many transformations this post-COVID predicament brings, more so than trying to quickly think our way out of it, into imagining a world in which not everyone works their way up to become a senior administrator, as it appears that we have managed much of this planet into oblivion, while simultaneously squeezing out the joy in leading an unambitious and ordinary life. Plus, ultimately, into trusting that it is now very much time to work towards making the impossible other world possible, particularly when we have a global crisis that threatens to instantly dismantle the security of what counts as normal. We will find that there are many clues, mechanisms, tools, modalities, perspectives, theories, philosophies, practices, and so on, for enabling this art of unthinking. Many of them can be found within radical endeavors such as decolonial feminism, anarchist geographies, critical pedagogy, indigenous knowledges, wisdom traditions, and so on. In fact, there may well be one too many options, especially for a world that is still obsessed with developing singular proofs of concept for the purpose of scaling up and other such formations of monopolies, generalizations, homogenizations, and heaven forbid even grand narratives. But this is exactly what we need right now, a pluriverse of alternatives that are also somehow equally yoked in value, as well as being available for each and every one of our particular individual and collective needs to know, to do, to love, and to fully become as we so envision.
Thank you, Epifania, for this inspiring call to action, namely for the communal over privatization and honoring cyclical modes of existence over continuous growth. And thank you once more to Ni Aite Sake and Solomon Sampa for entrusting us with your testimonies, and also to Mac Darling for graciously performing the interviews on site and translating from Ga. So in the next episode, we will be speaking to Dr. Jennifer Teleska about the managed extinction of the bluefin tuna. Thank you.
Eurovision.
Eurovision was commissioned by Arts Catalyst and Radar and developed in collaboration with the Istanbul Design Biennale. Eurovision has been generously supported by the Canada Council for the Arts, Arts Council England, and Action Culturelle Española.